Folks, welcome back to the NBC Network, the Biz World Channel, the iHealth Channel, the Works iHealth Radio with your host, Hurricane H, a new day, new show, and a sequence, or not a sequence, but another show in the realm of health care industry, but more in the role of operations and human resources, you name it. We're going to talk about it today with my expert, Dr. Khalil Biswas. He is a senior level consultant and a fractional executive with over 23 years of experience in global pharma, biotech, and med device leadership. He helps organizations and leaders synchronize culture, talent, and strategy for sustained growth and operational excellence. With that, Doctor, come on in. Let's talk. Let's see. Let's dive in and see how we can enlighten the world on the world of healthcare and how we can get, you know, some of these organizations, you know, really organize better and you know, maximize their opportunities for their staff.
Hey, Hurricane, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, a true pleasure, man. A true pleasure. So let's start first. I mean, a lot of experience. I mean, that's a mouthful of what I just stated there. You know, it's a lot of experience, a lot of expertise, and you know, let's break it down. Like your background. I mean, you're a scientist by default, by education. You know, and you've spend a lot of time in the world of pharma and, you know, and working with executives. You do the consulting now. You are actually, that's what you do. You are a lead. So let's talk about that, because these are all phenomenal works, you know, that anyone sure. That's listening or watching right now can be excited about. And, you know, there's a lot there. I mean, first of all, just the word pharma is big, right? I mean, there's a lot. And pharma is complex, right? Then the word scientist, and that's you. And so let's talk about your background and how you got into this whole thing, and how did you kind of move your way into the consulting space, and then we'll talk about like what are some of the things that you've observed, and some of the challenges that these organizations have, and then how we can solve them, and then how we can connect with you and get your services.
Hey, no, I think that's a great summary there of how we want to proceed with our chat today. Just again, delighted to be on here. And, you know, talk a little bit about my journey that began about 23 years ago, right, to this day. And, you know, I came out of graduate school. You know, I've got a PhD in chemistry. And, you know, coming out of graduate school, you really don't know what to expect, right? You know, as far as what that opportunity is going to look like, the first job that you take. And so, and I had a lot of opportunities to look at. And where I came into was the pharma sector. And so I began my career kind of learning the drug development process. Started an innovative drug company, and started at this was Eli Lilly and Company in Indianapolis, Indiana. Large pharmaceutical company, well-known company, and began my career there as a scientist in the laboratory, and learning how to develop analytical methods, validate analytical methods, and run samples. Right, running samples, you know, and being able to make sure that these met regulatory requirements. And so, because again, every medicine that's taken has to make sure that it has the appropriate safety and quality tied to it. And so this was, you know, where I spent my first couple of years. But during that time, it was realized, you know, fairly quickly by my management that I could lead initiatives and lead people. And so it began to supervise some folks. Also took on a scientific initiative, which at the time really scared me, right? When it was given to me, this was a global scientific initiative. And they're like, you know, we want you to take the lead on this. And I'm like, why me? Why would you want me to do this? And they're like, we think you're the right person. And I'm thinking about the people that I was going to bring in. That was the first thing I said. I was like, I alone, I'm not going to be able to do this, but I've got to bring the right people in. And so bringing the right people in, having the conversation with them, and figuring out how do we get this initiative to be something that we can truly implement. And that's where I learned very quickly is that it never is really about the person leading, it's the people that you have with you, right? And so bringing those people together, and these weren't just people local to my site, but globally, because we were a global company, and bringing those folks together, and we developed, you know, in the process, a couple of white papers that were key for this initiative, a couple of symposiums, and even an external publication that we were able to put out there, which was not easy to do. Coming out, you know, when you're coming from a regulated industry, you can imagine there's a lot of lawyers looking over what what we're putting out there, but we worked and effectively were able to do that. So that was something that, at the time, I didn't believe I could do it, but there were people that trusted me with this and, just working with the right people to move that along. Along during that time, early in my career, I learned that drug development process, taking everything from what were candidates, drug candidates, through those that were in phase one, going into that first human dose, and then go those that are in the clinical stage and learning about how that drug development process works, including how things work on the back end, where you have drugs that are now ready to be launched, whether it's in the United States or across the world, how to answer regulatory questions, right? Because you're going to get questions back from regulatory bodies, whether it's the FDA, whether it's the EMEA, or if you're doing in other countries as well, just making sure that you can understand the questions that come back and answering those questions. So that was also the learning I got in that first phase of my career. So gaining that experience from a scientific perspective, learning the regulatory aspects, the drug development process, and then getting some of those leadership opportunities was great. And that first 7 years of my career, that's what I was absorbed in. From there, I transitioned on into the U.S. FDA as a chemist, reviewer, and inspector. And so that next phase of my career was just really being on that back end. Okay, you're the ones now looking at all these companies and organizations that are developing these new medicines and new products, right? So being able to test methodologies, we actually had a laboratory in the FDA side I was at, then going on site with lead inspectors. So I served as a scientific and quality expert that would go on these inspections. And you learned a lot on inspections. What inspections taught was that you can go into a place and it looks pristine. But when you start to evaluate and go in there, you start to uncover things by asking the right questions and really spending the time with the people within different levels of the organization. There were times I was at sites for over 2 weeks, right, just to be able to get that level of information, and then being able to put this together in a format to give back to that sponsor so they can utilize that information effectively. Because my role, when I looked at this, was not to make it tougher for them to get their product through, because you want their product to be able to get to the patients they need, but you need to also identify where their gaps are, right, and make sure those gaps are closed effectively. So that was a very enlightening part of my career. And from there, certainly opportunities came, and I went to the contract research side. So contract research organizations, just for awareness here, are those organizations that partner with these innovative drug companies. Because at that time, outsourcing of phases of work was started to become more commonplace. And so I worked, within a contract research organization, and I'll tell you, you wear a lot of different hats in those organizations. You're doing, you're talking with clients, which are these sponsors that have their new drug, their new molecules they want to move forward. You're doing, you're putting proposals together. You're working with the sales team. And then you're, running the operation. So I was responsible for that non-clinical development portion of the business. So I was responsible for the science, the operations, and the P&L. I mean, that's one thing you think as a scientist, that you don't need to know the financial side. Well, you've got a business you're running there. You've got to be able to show that profit and loss and be able to show your top line and bottom line each month, right? And again, the organization I was owned by private equity. So this was something that was very carefully watched, right? And so that was a great learning I got, for a few years wearing all those hats. But what was most rewarding for me was always working with those clients, those sponsors, right? Listening to them, hearing how they want to move their molecule forward and how to move it forward in an effective manner, but making sure that all the regulations are being met. So again, it was really a great experience. By doing that, the company I was with got purchased by another company, which is not uncommon, right? Because you think anything that's PE owned eventually is going to be purchased by someone. And so we were purchased. And so during that time, I was involved with some of the integration efforts, which was, again, getting the organizations to come together, getting processes together, getting systems together, getting best practices together. And so, with that, you get a lot of learning at the same time, and then also getting the people aligned as well, right? And that's something that, you know, I've just continued to find is that people alignment becomes so important, right? In everything that you do, because people focus on so many of the other things. They take focus on systems and processes and procedures, and all that is great. But if your people aren't, if you're not engaged with your people and they're not aligned, they're not in the right roles, then it's all for none. And so that's something that I was very important as I was going through this integration at that time. And the company that purchased us at the time was Charles River Laboratories, which is, you know, a large contract research organization. And so, you know, within that, you know, you there's a lot to learn from when you're now part of a publicly traded company versus something that's private equity owned. So did that for a few years. And then, you know, and then I was asked to, within the same company there, to go essentially develop another organization. So again, I was doing all small molecule work at the time. And they said, we need you to get this biologics organization set up at one of our sites, close down the site that one of the sites that we purchased, and bring those folks over into this new site. And so I spent some time to do that, right? And that was about a 2.5 year journey of getting that organization in place, getting the right people in the right roles, and getting that business up and running. And that was, you know, a very rewarding experience, but one that, you know, certainly you learned a lot through the process. And the big learning you got, again, was people, right? Dealing with the emotions that people were dealing with as they were, you know, having to go through this change of, you know, because some of these folks did not want to go to the site that we were building up there, but we needed those folks. So how do you get them in there? How do you get them comfortable? How do you listen to the challenges that they're facing? And then building that team up, getting that leadership team in place, and then getting that organization up and running to a good business there. So that was, you know, that last phase of my journey there at Charles River Laboratories, to when then I had a pause and I began to start some of my consulting, and which is, you know, where I opened up my own LLC and really started to support pharmaceutical consulting and really helping small to mid-sized companies move their molecules through the drug development process. Did that for a little while, and then I spent, tapped on the shoulder here about 2 years ago to oversee a medical device testing organization. And as it may be apparent here, my background had all been in the pharma side for almost, you know, 20 years. And I said, medical devices? I was like, I don't know anything about that. Regulations are different. Testing requirements are different. They said, I think you can do this. You're the one we want to do this. And so I spent about 2.5 years, you know, in this role, and, you know, was able to get that business in a good place, you know, where they were able to, you know, the organization really had got a lot more technical recognition for what they could do. The people started to get moving in the right direction there. And then, you know, it was and just getting everyone aligned again. Again, came back to people and people alignment, but also making sure the science was being done appropriately. Because the science was a little different, right? In the medical device space, the regulations were a bit different, and getting all those in the right spot. And so that's where I spent the last 2.5 years. And now I'm back in full time consulting. You know, where this is what I do. I serve in fractional roles. I do consulting for individual companies, and this is both technical and leadership consulting.
Oh, you know, I'm listening to you. Like, you're like, where do I begin, man? It's a lot of stuff. I want to touch on every single thing you've talked about there, because there's a lot of pieces there that really we can use a lot of, you know, I guess, expansion on, right, in terms of discussion. Sure. Because it's for lack of better words, I mean, it's an intense world that you were in, right? And there's a lot of stuff, a lot of moving parts. And, you know, sure, we'll try to summarize it in the time frame that we have. But so a couple of things. First of all, I mean, you got me at chemistry, obviously. If you're in the chemistry world, you know, that's, first of all, I give you, you know, chapeau there, like a hats off to you, because You know, I did chemistry when I was in my early days, and you know, it was fun, but you know, it is complex, and there's so much. I mean, you could become a pharmacist, or in your case, a chemist, and then you get into the back end of things in the science world and the lab and get all that. So that's pretty exciting stuff. So I mean, that journey is awesome in its own right, and that it gets you into the world. Now, you did mention something about innovative pharmacies, or I mean, pharma companies. I just want you, if you can just define what those are, because we know pharma is big, Pfizer, Merck, you know, the big names, right? But like, you know, you're right, there are these companies that are smaller in a way, and obviously you work with some of the larger ones, but the guys that are just working on a particular molecule or something, did they get it off the ground? They doing maybe like testing on some sort of a disease element or whatever, on illness, and they're working on some sort of cure, well, not cure, but like medicine to it and things like that. I mean, there's a touchy feeling about cure versus, you know, drugs. Sure. You know, some people sensitive, like, well, they're not curing, they're just fixing. Well, I mean, we can debate that later. We're gonna stay neutral here because this is a big topic, right? But I love also, and we'll go back to that question, but I love the idea that you worked on the inside and on the regulatory side, and you know, which is a very good contrast. And actually, I think the best people that can be auditors or the, you know, basically inspectors and really reviewing, you know, the process, other people who have been in the trenches that know it inside out. And that's what you see in the IRS. You see it in the auditing, you know, world. You know, you have those people that have been in the plans for, like in my world, right? And by the way, I relate to a lot of stuff because in the insurance space, especially in government programs, we work with CMS and DOH and things like that. So a lot of some of the people that work, for example, CMS, come from the world of medicine and healthcare and insurance. And so they're inside out, they know it inside out. So it's fascinating to see, like, that's almost a similar path that you took there in terms of, you know, how you can do it. But let's talk about just the innovative example. Like what they really, sure, just to bring it closer to the audiences.
Absolutely. So when we talk about innovative companies, and I think, you know, Hurricane, we can look at this, and this can be small biotech companies, and these can be companies of one person, right? They've one person and one molecule, and they've got this that they want to get out to treat a particular disease state. Or you have those mid-sized companies that have that level of more folks and more capacity to be able to do it. And then you've got the large companies, like you've mentioned there, the Mercks, the Pfizers, the Eli Lillys, right? So all of them we consider as innovative companies because they're all doing that innovative side where they're focusing on a particular disease state that they want to get to market, right? And so it just depends the size of these. And so when I worked in contract research, in the contract research organization space, I worked with all of them. So I would call all of them innovative companies, right? What they were doing is outsourcing aspects of it where they didn't have as much expertise, or they didn't want to utilize that capacity in-house, right? And so that's where that comes in. But when you talk about innovative companies, it can be as small as N of one to a company that has 10,000 people.
Well, thank you. And Val, again, I just wanted to clarify that because, sure, obviously, you know, all these pharma companies, I mean, they're innovative because they come up with drugs almost every season. There is a new product that comes up for a different illness and things like that. I mean, obviously they get the brand, they have their patents for it and all the stuff. And then, sure, they have 20 years of, you know, hopefully they get I think they all do. I mean, they got the best lawyers out there, so they can make it where they have their 20 years in the make, and then that's it. And that's the other thing. I mean, now that I'm just touching on that, can you just briefly guide, you know, a little bit of a, maybe just the elements of process of what a pharma company goes through in terms of from, you know, molecule, you know, development to final stage, and as you stated, where it's actually in final trial in the population.
Of course, yeah. So that's one thing that I'm very passionate about, you know, is the drug development process and, you know, how this is. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to share this in different forums, right? A lot of people don't realize that medicine that's sitting in your medicine cabinet, right, or just anywhere in your house, right, what that takes and the amount of failure that there's there. If you think of every 10,000 candidates this is something that's a proof of concept candidate, one of those makes it to market. One. So one in 10,000. So you think about that. Wow, that's... You know, so you think for folks that have worked in this space, they don't get to see many that get to that point, right? Unless you're fortunate, because what's happening is as it goes through the process, you start from there, you go through discovery, and then you select a candidate, a viable candidate that you can take into an animal study, right? And so that's where you can do your first safety studies, right? And so once that happens, is then we can actually go into, once it's completed the safety studies, it can go into a phase one
human trial.
People study at that at that point where, you know, where you can actually start to look at efficacy, at what dose this is going to be appropriate. Goes from phase one to phase two to phase three, and then you now go into the commercialization stage, and you actually have a product that can go, that can be now launched and put out there. So you can imagine during each of those phases, the chances of something, whether it can move forward, right? Because you may have safety data early on that says, hey, this is not viable. We've got to shelf it. You now take it into phase one. Now you've got efficacy data that's showing that's not viable at this point, that, you know, we're not going to get a dose that's going to be effective, or one that's causing inadvertent and negative effects on the patients, you know, themselves. So then you've got to shelf it at that point, because risk is something that as you keep moving along, you've got to have less and less risk, because the more risk you have, you're now, you know, it opens up doors for other issues at that point. And so, you know, that's 10 to 15 years, that process, right? You know, go from discovery to launch, one in 10,000 candidates. And then we look at the price tag, and this is the thing that gets, you know, this industry gets hit hard on, is how expensive it is, right? It was, when I started about 20 years ago, around $1 billion. But these drugs, you know, to get these drugs to market, it can be anywhere from there to about $2 billion, right? You know, to be able to do, to go through. And this is taking into account the cost of the molecule itself, all the steps it has to go through that process. And you're thinking about, again, a 10 to 15 year window. Can you reduce that window? You can, but these the molecules that we're putting out there today and the drug products that we're getting out there today are more complex. They require more scrutiny. And there's a lot of new things that are happening too when you look at some of these customized, personalized medicine. So that's, you know, if you look at it from the high level, that's your process there. And you go from discovery, candidate selection, phase one, through clinical trials to launch, right? And 10 to 15 years, one in 10,000 make it. And you're talking about, probably $1 billion in costs.
Those numbers are amazing. I'm just looking at you, listening. You're like, whoa. I mean, you think there's a lot of money and stuff, but the work and the effort, the time frame, and the cost. I mean, the final cost, as you said. I mean, that's like, you know, these are humongous numbers. I mean, it's like, you know, you can't fathom, especially if they're working on 10 molecules. I mean, you're talking billions. Yeah. So this is what they refer to as research and development process, correct? Is that what? Yeah. So,
and that's R&D. Right. And where it gets expensive is in the clinical stage, right? Because, you know, you've got to recruit patients, volunteers to come into these trials. And then, this is where, you know, it takes even, there's more costs involved there at that stage at that point. So that's when a lot of times when you hear from the public that, gosh, medicines are so expensive to develop. Well, they are, right? And I've been being in the trenches there and being in there with these innovative companies and these contract research organizations, you really appreciate how complex it is and how expensive the process is.
Well, thank you. So now that does just, thank you for clarifying these pieces. And by the way, when I was thinking about the innovative, like I thought, like thought about Amgen or some of those companies that do like specific molecules for cures. But you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, like you said, even the big pharmas, you know, are have their innovative, you know, groups and research where they do all this studies, or, you know, so what we're going to do, what kind of, you know, medicine do we want to pursue, and so on and so forth. But you're right. I mean, what I couldn't even understand the idea of 10,000 potential molecules that wind up in one. I mean, that's like, wow. Yeah. I mean, which means a lot of work. I mean, 10,000 is not a small number, especially if you're working on molecules here. I mean, you're the chemist, you know that there's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, to come up with that molecule with, you know, a lot of pieces to it and all these atomic things that are, it's funny, you know, it's funny when you look at the actual drugs and you look, I don't know, I have not seen them a lot in the States, but overseas they have this paper that comes in. And it actually shows you the molecule. I think maybe they have them here, right? Because, you know, you go to a drug pharmacy, they give you the tubes. But really overseas, you get them like in actually a box, and it comes in with a big, you know, pamphlet that has the molecule, and you can see all the different, you know, parts of them, the atomic, you know, pieces of that. I'm like, what the hell? Like, you can't figure this stuff out. Obviously, you can't. But, but, you know, it's amazing how, like, you know, just to relate to it now, it's, and visualize it, it's big. I mean, it's huge. And also, now so that leads me to the idea. Yeah, that night. So you worked inside, and you understand this process. But then you said these phases, it could stop at any given point. Now, that could be you as the FDA guys. You come in and you do what you said earlier. You scrutinize and you know what to look for. And then, whoops, hold on. This is not going to go through. Ouch. That's got to hurt. I mean, I know you were not liked at that stage.
You know, and that's the thing is, you know, when they submit, for example, if they're in, when you talk about phase one, you submit an investigation to a new drug, an IND package, right? So when that package is submitted, you can, I mean, being on both ends of this, you feel for those sponsors because many of them, this may be their one molecule, right? That they're getting a chance to get it out there. And if we find something that's significant, then it goes back and it delays them. So that's going to delay them being able to get this to move forward in the next phase. Or it could even stop it, depending on what the finding is, right? And every reviewer I've worked with, every inspector I've worked with, our goal is not to stop these companies from moving forward, because we know what they're trying to do is trying to get life-saving medicines or medicines that are going to treat a disease state out there. So we want to help them, right? And so one of the advice I always gave companies is that get us involved early. When I was with the agency, I said, get us involved early in the process. Let's be proactive in this, because that way we can help you address any issues that could come up so we don't have anything significant at the end. Will there be findings? Yeah. Anytime you have someone who has a quality hat on, there's going to be some findings. It's just the significance of those findings is what you want, and you want to avoid those, those larger ones. And I think the more those conversations are happening with them, where it's a collaboration with the FDA and that innovative company, the chances for success are higher, and the chances for less significant findings are higher. So
thank you. And so there's a couple of things. One question is, some people say, well, you know, the FDA reviews things, right? But obviously they operate in the world of pharma, therefore they almost need to kind of get those drugs through. I mean, to a certain point, right? So there's always that controversy, like, you know, yes, you are regulatory, but you also exist with those companies, meaning if these companies don't have, absolutely, you know, they don't have any work done, I mean, you don't have a use, right, as an organization. So it's kind of like almost a conflict in itself, but how to navigate that? I mean, obviously we do. I mean, the FDA exists and we have these relationships, but I love what you said about the concept. I mean, by the way, that's the same thing, for example, for us, which in the context of CMS, you know, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, you know, services, and, you know, the insurance companies and stuff. So we're the same. They work, they're regulatory, and they audit us and everything, but they work in tandem. We follow their rules and regulations, all the chapters and things like that to make sure it's all stuff. But it is, I mean, they exist, you know, for us, we exist with them. So it's a coexisting, you know, concept when you're talking about these entities, right? The regulatories versus the organizations and, you know, as you said, sponsors.
Partnership. But, I mean, bottom line, it's a partnership. That's how I look at this. And this is what I've always encouraged on both ends, is that let's not be, you know, the FDA doesn't have to just be the policeman. They can also be business partners with them. But again, partnership in the sense that we're working together towards a common goal. Our common goal is what? To get these products to the patients that need them.
So thank you. So, but there's a question that always comes to mind, and I've heard this before. Now, it might sound controversial, kind of a little extreme, but there are people that say, well, the FDA has the, you know, a list of things, checklist, check mark, right? And as long as these pharma companies kind of make their 100% check mark, they can go through the process. I mean, I guess that's the process, but some people may not be as excited about that, because as long as you meet these minimum requirements, you qualify, right? And so what does that mean? I mean, again, that sometimes creates the concept or the idea of, well, these companies are going to do the best just to make, you know, the check marks and pass. You know, it's like doing 70 in a state exam, right? And you don't have to go 100, you just got to go 70. So is that even an accurate, you know, statement? Again, there are people that probably watching this show be like, well, you know what? I don't trust these guys. Because, I mean, listen, I mean, this is a big topic. I mean, we hear a lot of back and forth on, you know, an echo on the world of pharma and regulatory stuff. But this is a question, right, that may come to mind. What, just your take on it. I mean, hopefully there's no bias here or no trouble for you answering that one.
So I think, you know, really what you're asking there is the speed, right? I think is where you're coming to here. Just make sure I understand your question. right?
Well, not the speed. So this is something I've been watching, you know, over and over in different discussions. There are people that can say, well, you know, in order for you, for example, to and I've had some discussions on different things, on vitamins and supplements. Basically, you have a minimum requirement for any drug or any particular product to pass, right?
Yep.
So as long as you meet those minimum requirements, you don't have to go beyond. Even the ingredients don't have to be extravagant. You just have the, you know, so you have a threshold, 100% of this or 50% of that. As long as you have that that volume, you're good to go. And to some people, that's not enough. And so is that a truth, you know, or to it, or like you guys go, no, we want more of this?
Yeah. So really, it comes down to what phase you are in development, right? And I think that's what it comes down to. So when you get to that final phase, when we're talking about things that are in commercialization, right? Whether you have a new drug, an NDA or a biologic or a BLA application, right? The rigor is more, right? The rigor is significantly more at that point, because now you know that you're having to commercialize this drug at scale. And then you're having to get real. This is really going to get into larger numbers of patients, right? And so there's no shortcuts at that point. And you have to be able to meet all the expectations of what that type of drug molecule is going to need, right? To be able to get to. So, you know, there's nothing abbreviated at that point. Where you can potentially do a little less is earlier on, because you want to fail early, right? But when you get to that back end, I know a lot of times if you think from the public perspective, like, oh, they can't, they're just getting these things through. Well, no, there are expectations, there are regulatory requirements, and those have to be met, because the impact then is much larger. Again, a great example of this is you think of the time of COVID-19 and getting these vaccines out. And there was a lot of concern, like, how did they do this so quickly? Well, resources were put there. Again, I was, you know, involved with some of this, and I could tell you that we know that the safety and efficacy was not compromised when this was being done, because if you do, the impact is larger, right? At the end of the day, what we do is you have to pull resources and you have to get funding right in place. And that's what was done to make sure that could happen. So there can't be, you know, I would say there are minimum requirements for things, but as you get further into development, the scrutiny is much heavier, right? And so because of that, you've got to be thinking, you know, even more, and sometimes you do a bit more, but you've got to make sure, you know, that that what you're putting out there is not going to come back later, because the impact of that is much bigger. So hopefully that answers the question.
Well, it does. And I think it puts a little bit of a good feel that, you know, no one's getting away with murder. And yes, the scrutiny is there. Yeah. And you know what? You got to really make the threshold to be able to go forward to the next level. Otherwise, as you said earlier, this could be the hiccup that can turn that molecule into a dead end, and that's it. So thank you for clarifying that. And again, so if you're watching or listening and you had a question about that, hopefully we tackled that one in a very diplomatic way here. Yeah. So I love what you said also earlier about the idea that you work in as a contract, you know, phase, where you can help these companies kind of guide them through the process. Sure. So in sort of, it's a consulting gig, right? You're helping them get through the nuances of, you know, from this stage one to the final phases, what to avoid. As you said, I love what you said earlier, even about the idea of partnership. And, you know, if the FDA goes along with some of these folks early on, they can, okay, we want to do this drug for this. Okay, well, maybe now that maybe, so this is it just popped in my head now. Is there like an entity within the FDA that actually is dedicated to do that at early stages, to partner with them and guide them before they can get into the actual phase of submission?
Yeah. And so it's within any part of the agency. So again, if you, depending on which part of the agency would be the one evaluating that package, is just getting in conversations with their management, and they welcome those discussions, right? Those pre-meetings, right? To be able to go over, hey, this is what we're going forward, thinking of going forward with. What do you think of what we've got? What do you think of our strategy at this point? And again, I've never seen a time where they've turned these down. So really what it comes down to is getting involved with management at that level. So for example, if it's going to the Center of Drug Evaluation and Research, which is CDER, you get in touch with CDER management there and say, hey, we have a compound that we want to move forward. This is where it's at right now. Can we have a discussion, right? But what a lot of times, you know, I think what happens is I think there's lack of awareness, you know, that companies and organizations can do that, have these discussions. And two is they say, well, maybe I think we can do this and we'll just wait for those questions later. I always believe the proactive approach is the best approach. And I, being on both ends of this, I can tell you that that is always going to be the most successful. You're going to lead to the most successful outcomes.
Especially with a price tag of $1 billion. I think if you can save half of that early on with you know, bypassing some of those mistaken steps, you know, I think that, that will be very welcome. And talk, so this will relate earlier to what you said, P&L. I mean, you and at least on the medical devices piece, P&L is a big, and by the way, I was talking to my son about, he's doing a business major, and we're talking about, like, you know, in my career path, you know, the main thing, I don't care what element, what lifestyle, what you do, it's always business equals P&L. I mean, if you know this, then that's really what business is about. There's no business that's there unless you get a profit or loss and you get those profits higher than those losses. Bottom line. So everything else in between is just to get you to that point. So it was, it's funny that you said that, and that is a fact. Pharmacy, pharma, healthcare, insurance, any business type, small, large, it's the same concept. So now I want to, you said something very powerful earlier that that will actually take us to the second phase of the discussion, which is really what you do more about the consulting piece and helping the leadership and the culture and so on and so forth. And that is that you said that it's not about leaders, it's about people. You said that a couple of times. And you know what? I think it gets lost in the management cycle, the management mind, like, you know, we're the boss, you know, this, that. And there is nobody, there's no one that can succeed. I mean, no company exists without the people. And if the people are not in sync, the people are not following the vision, they're not buying into the vision of whatever it is, they're not going to do it. If you come in and bring in a bunch of people in the room and you tell them, I want to do this and this, and you guys going to do this, they're just going to walk away. If they don't see what the value is. Now, granted, people get into companies, you know, obviously to make money. People, you know, go through education. They have a loan. They have this, that, the other. They have a life. They want to have a certain lifestyle. And so they do this stuff. But it doesn't stop. You know, sometimes if they're in the wrong place, they're going to walk away, and certainly it's going to affect them and the company. So I love what you said about that. That's a big, huge piece that anyone that's out there in the business world, whether you're an employee or an employer or anywhere in between that level, it is about the people. It's about, you know, the human factor. And if we can do it right and can appreciate that, I mean, even in there are studies where there are actually good concepts out there about, if you want your customers, your first customers are your employees and your staff and your people. Because if they're right and you're right, everybody else is going to be treated right. And therefore, every outcome is going to be right, right? So,
and I think that's so important. And that's what I've always done. When I come into an organization, right, is I go and have this conversation with the people within the organization that I'm responsible for, as well as those that are tangential to that group, right? And making sure I understand them, the roles they're in, the problems that they're facing, and then use that to kind of say, okay, where do we need to make appropriate adjustment? And then utilize the people and their ideas to solve those problems, right? Because a lot of times leaders come in and say, oh, I've got to solve it, right? I'm the leader of this organization. No, if you've got people and you engage those folks and you put them in the right place to succeed, they will do it. And they will do it so with so much excitement and so much passion that you're going to get great outcomes at the end of the day. So trusting them, but being there and supporting them too. I think that's what's important, is that sometimes you'll hear people, even when they're in an organization, like, I'm not getting the support that I need. And then you say, what is it? Well, you know, they just give me a task and that's it. And at the end, when something goes wrong, I just get the blame for it. Well, it shouldn't be that way, right? Again, it's the same thing. It's a partnership. It's a partnership with your leadership to make sure that, hey, I've got your back when things are going wrong, and I'm going to support you. I'm going to figure out what we need to do to fix that. So again, it comes down to people, leadership taking the time to understand their people, because you get the people right, you start doing the science right, you get the operations right. Revenue, you know, when you talk about P&L, is just an outcome. That's an outcome at the end of the day, if you do that right. And that's what I've seen over the years, is that, you know, whenever people, you know, you see organizations, they focus so much on that back end, focus more on the front, right? You're going to see that's where all the issues are, because they're going to tell you everything, right? But you have to build that trust with them first.
Well, thank you. And you know, it's amazing, because again, no one can succeed unless we teamwork makes a dream work, as they say, right? And really, that's all there is. I mean, we work together towards the common goal, and the results will be there. If we do it right, it's your foundation. Everything else follows, you know, nicely. Now, again, I mean, this doesn't mean that it's a free for all and nobody has accountability. There's no, scrutiny on and policies and process, you know, and procedures, sure, and things like that. There's workflows, there's tasks, there's, you know, accountability 100%. To a certain, you know, a degree. But it has to be done in the right element. As you said, it's a partnership. Everybody buys in and everybody's contributing to the same thing. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, like in the world I was for many years, you know, I was given the opportunity to be part of, like, almost like you felt that you owned the company, although you didn't, and you were given the latitude and the flexibility and autonomy to act, you know, in your capacity and your department, whatever, to operate correctly. And when you do, you feel like you want to do more, because now the minute, you know, you don't feel that, that's when you feel not appreciated. And that's when you start like moving away from a company, and then, you know, that's it. And I've seen companies really stall because they lost that level. So that takes me to this question. So in your experience, what's the biggest blind spot companies face when trying to align culture with business strategy? And how do you help them uncover it?
Yeah, the biggest blind spot is they immediately think that it's not it's not a people issue. Right? It's just, you know, they've got an issue within their operations. They've got a capacity issue. I mean, they'll go to the things that are the high level stuff. But when you find out, it's like, you know, how much did you take the time to really talk to those folks and to really get the time to understand them? And that's usually where things get quiet, right, at that point. Well, we have an idea. They'll give you a high level. I think, but really, how deep did you dive in, right? And that takes time. Right, that's the reality of it. Is what I found out is being in organizations is that's what takes time, is to really understand the people, build trust with them, and then be able to move that forward. So I think that's a lot of time that I think that organizations aren't fully aware of how significant their people problem is. I think they know there's a people problem, but they never know the significance of that. Right, I think that's where that becomes maybe the core issue at the end of the day, and it's not really more an operational issue. Or a quality issue at the end of the day that might be, you know, holding the organization back. It is culture. It is people at the end of the day. But those are the things that take time and it takes a lot of work to get those back. To redevelop a culture, you're talking about a couple of years, right? And you'll see small progressions through that, right? It's not going to turn right away sometimes. That's the thing that, you know, I think a lot of things people might be like, okay, you've got a people issue, you've got a culture issue. How fast can I turn that over? Well, you know, you can show them a timeline, right? This is what I expect to see. But typically there is, you know, I'd say, you know, a 2-year period where you're going to see that change, and you'll see that incremental change, but it may not turn as fast as people would like. But that's where I see the blind spots are.
Well, thank you. And you know, you touch on something called operations. And by the way, I think that's usually a very big, you know, component of any company, right? And okay. So I can tell you just my personal experience in the world of, you know, corporate. I mean, over 30 years, literally. And, you know, I've been in the business development, sales, marketing, and that, sure, kind of, and operations of sales, but dealing with, you know, company operations in general, right? And you know, there's always a disconnect to a degree, because there is a leadership vision. There is the targets that are set by the company. This is what you have to do. And then now you want to deliver the services, you want to deliver the product, whatever, and you push because you want to meet those targets and stuff. So now you get into a retention, you know, of customers and, you know, membership and, you know, I guess whatever that crowd that you're addressing, you know, that you're dealing with in terms of your product and services. And then you have, you know, the internal partners or the different departments that actually support stuff. Sometimes there is, as you said, people want to grow quick and bigger, and they don't match up the numbers. And so therefore they're short. I mean, the growing pains, as we call them, right? You know, you move too fast, you grow too fast, but you cannot catch up with your operations, and it causes problems and hiccups. And now you have bad experiences, you know, from your consumers and customers, you know, and you know, that becomes a problem. And that's usually a big challenge for us, for example, from the sales end and, you know, and business operations, you know, because they're like, well, you guys are doing this. What are you doing wrong? We're not doing anything. We're doing our job. The job is to deliver the numbers, to deliver the membership, deliver the customer base, and now you have to deliver the services that we actually are pitching. And so, and that's the other thing, like, we try to do this in advance as a team. And so, and by the way, that's in my experience, the more we did that in advance as a group, this is where we're going. And by the way, I've had this actually something happened to me in a previous company where So I was leading the sales division, and somebody was there before me. So the marketing team was not under our, you know, work, right? So you know how marketing sometimes goes into sales, sales goes into marketing. So we were completely separate, but we work very, you know, good together. And one of the things that I was, you know, that I offered is that let me come and talk to the marketing team about what is our tactical stuff, what is our strategy, how are we going to go out there, and so on and so forth. What territories, what this, what that. And they looked at me like, wow, you know, we didn't have this direction before. We just marketed. We did marketing, you know, but it was not, you know, strategic marketing. We didn't know why, you know, this zip code versus this zip code, this crowd versus the other crowd, this demographic. And so they were just, you know, I would say I'm not doing the tap on my shoulder here, but the fact is, it was just a simple, you know, thing that I was sharing with them. But that's what I talked about earlier. You want to share the vision. They want to buy the vision. And if they don't understand the vision, then there's nothing to buy, right? And so it makes a big difference. And so I think for people who are watching, if you're a business person, your leadership in a role, you know, make sure that everybody's aligned correctly. And that, by the way, there's something that I've championed, you know, for years now. That is, if you want everybody to be on the same page, with the leadership and the sales and all the stuff and the growth, everybody's going to have a stake at it. They need to have a stake at it, meaning that, you know, you can't not have any accountability to the final numbers in the P&L and expect these people to actually be in line 100%. It just doesn't work that way. I mean, again, that's just my thing. I mean, what do you think?
100%. I mean, I think we're aligned in our thinking here. And this is what, when you talk about tangential groups, right? We talk about sales, marketing, quality, and then your operations teams, and then even your finance partners. All of them are partners in this process, because at the end of the day, you need to understand what they need, and making sure that they're aligned with the vision of what you're trying to get accomplished there. So really your language and your speak with them might have to change a little bit as a leader, how you communicate with them, how you talk with your operations team versus your quality team versus your sales team versus your marketing team versus your manufacturing team, if you think about it. All of them, but you need to understand their pain points and then really be able to figure out, how do I work with them effectively? And I think that's where leaders, you know, really can really thrive at the end of the day, if they take that time to really understand that, to move, as you said there, to a common outcome, and then that leads to great outcomes at the end. I mean, the challenges we're facing today is what we're seeing: significant pressures, you know, with budget cuts, and, you know, organizations having to do more with less, and that gets hard, right? But there's still ways to do that, right? Because I've been in those types of organizations too. Because again, it comes back down to, okay, what becomes our priorities now? We're having to work with less. We've got a smaller budget to work with. We still need to get this done. What things are essential versus what things aren't? But making sure our people are not over, you know, they're not getting stretched too much, but they're also being effectively utilized in their organization. So that's that becomes another piece of this. You
know? Well, thank you. So now that leads me. Now, you were in the scientific world. You are a scientist, and, you know, I mean, how do you guide technical or scientific leaders who are strong in their domain, but really struggle with influence or strategic thinking? I mean, it's very common. Yeah. People are good at what they do, but now when it comes to dealing with people and you know, yeah, culture and stuff, that's not really their forte. So it becomes a little bit, especially at the higher levels. I mean, some people are tremendously smart, but they just have no clue about how to operate the other stuff. Now, there are strategies to do it, but how do you do, and you as a consultant, how do you approach that?
Yeah, so I go back to my time when I was and this is not even long ago, when you lead these organizations and you're talking to scientists. And I spend a lot of time talking to scientists, and why I can relate to scientists is I was one myself, right? You've got to find out what they really want to do. If they want to continue to do science, wonderful. Make sure you're doing that science, but make sure what you're doing ties with the business well, and make sure you can effectively communicate that. And that's one thing I teach them, is that don't share all the details of every experiment that you ran or every sample that you ran. What's the most salient points there, and get those across. Those who want to go into management, it's a different story. So when you speak with them, you need to explain to them that a scientist going into management is a different skill set, right? Because now you're not just doing good science anymore. You're now having to learn a skill set of how to manage people, right? And you have to get that into their head. And a lot of times what happens is leaders come in there and they say, hey, you were really good as a scientist. you're also going to be, we're going to move you into a management role, and they don't give them the appropriate training or awareness, and then they go and they don't succeed in that role. What happens then? That discourages that person, and they may then a conclusion is based in that, hey, this person is no longer a strong performer, a strong employee anymore. Well, what did you do to prepare that person for that role? And it's not just putting them in a training class, it's really teaching them. It's teaching them that, you know, when you're managing a group of people or even a person, it's everything about that person. It's not just the projects that they're running. It's about them as a person, how they're growing, how they're developing. Are you considering a development plan for them? How are you measuring them, you know, on how they're doing as far as their progress? You know, when it's not just mid-year at end of the year, you're checking on them regularly. And are you doing those things, right? And so when you do that, a lot of times scientists or technical people say, oh, I don't want to do that. I want to keep doing what I'm doing here, and I want to keep growing as a scientist. Or others say, yeah, I'm ready to take that leap, and I'm willing to do those things because it is going to be a bit different from the role that I'm doing right now, which is purely a scientific role.
Well, again, I'm sure it comes with a little bit of work and, you know, guidance. But again, that's where your expertise comes in. You kind of help them navigate that part, and that's great.
That's right.
And so again, folks out there, if you're struggling, not sure, and you're in the scientific world and you want some guidance, I think we have, you know, the go-to person here that can assist with that. Now you mentioned earlier you worked with, you know, some large companies and international stuff.
Yeah.
Now,
sure.
What are some of the key insights on, let's say, maintaining performance and cohesion in cross-cultural environments? I mean, working with, you know, you're looking at the States, you're looking at maybe somewhere in Asia. And so different cultures, different, you know, work ethics and stuff like that. How do you all that, you know, work with that? And how do you, I guess, address that with leadership, you know, and how they can make it work?
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic question. And so it's something that, you know, I've got to see firsthand through many organizations that I've worked in. What you find even within a site, you think there's a culture for one site. No, there's silos, right? And what you, one of the first things you got to do is, how do you break those silos down? So you start to bring those people into meetings, discussions, and a lot of face-to-face type stuff, right? Now, when you go overseas and you're thinking about, you know, if you look at the APAC region or you're looking at Europe, you know, and you've got to also appreciate now that, okay, I'm on the other side of the ocean now. I not only need to understand and appreciate the work that they're doing there, but also their culture, right? How do they communicate at the end of the day? Some may not be as comfortable communicating maybe on a Zoom call. They may be more comfortable writing something on an email, or they may be more comfortable on a one-on-one call. And I've seen that with a lot of times when I'm working with folks that are overseas, is that they're not saying a word on the call, right? And I'm like, they never make an assumption. And it's like, you reach out to them at that point and you talk to them. And they're like, oh, you know, I just wasn't comfortable talking there. I'm more comfortable talking now. And then you have to explain to them that, you know, that, okay, you know, that's important. But it's always important to get your message across. So when you talk about culture can be impacted by within a site, within a country, or certainly across sites as well. And it takes, you know, you just have to take the time to understand that culture, those people, and then being able to bring the best out of them into the organization. And again, it's something that you have to build that trust with them where they feel comfortable. And that's one thing I always try to do is that at the beginning, it's not about the work, what we're doing. It's, are you comfortable? Let's just talk. Let's just have a chat conversation and talk. And then let me understand your world a bit. And then how do I bring the best of that into what we're trying to do here? But the reality of it is, the larger your organization gets, the more silos there are, and your goal is to start to break those down as much as possible. But you've got to make a lot of effort to do that, right? Some of it is going physically out there, right? You go out to that site, right? And you go and see it, or even within. And I used to see that in an organization where you've got operations here, manufacturing there. Well, walk over to the manufacturing building, go and talk to those folks a little bit, right? And understand what their life is like. Go see a day in their life, right? You're going to understand a lot about them. So.
Well, thank you. And by the way, that's a strategy. I personally use that in a lot of different companies where you want to have all your partners really partners, meaning that you have to be with them, you have to engage with them at work, outside of work. You really have, you create a good partnership so they understand you, their logics and stuff, and you work with them. Understand them too, because sometimes we also have to see the other side, right? And in the context of working overseas, I mean, you know, people have to understand the culture, to be prepared for that transition. I mean, you go in there, you want to do some due diligence as to how things are working and operating so you can engage with them correctly and get the best results. I love what you said. The idea is you can't do it from a boardroom somewhere in, you know, and by the way, I see this in nationals, you know, where everything is quartered somewhere in a headquarter place somewhere in the Midwest or South, you know, East, or for example, for us in the insurance space. And they come to the New York market, and that's just an example. They have no clue about the New York market and how it operates. It's a completely different. New York City is just a different animal the way it works, right? And then you come in with the mentality of being somewhere in, I don't know, in the middle of Texas. It's not going to be the same, right? And so those things are, you know, you got to know, you know, at least get the people that are local to run the place and the show correctly. They understand it and listen to them, not just come, look, we're going to do this our way. Your way may not work here. By the way, you know, this Hurricane H literally comes from a story that I was in New York all my career pretty much, and then I went to Pennsylvania. So when I was there, the pace was completely different. So I was coming in like a storm. And people would come up, here comes Hurricane H, right? And so that's where it stood. But that's the thing. So there is always a cultural shock when you actually move, you know, a process, a company, especially when you mentioned earlier mergers and people get acquired, well, right? Acquisition. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you hit the last piece there as well, something I want to touch upon here. I know we're probably getting close on time, but I've been involved with a couple of acquisitions, right? And when you're involved in acquisitions, that's where you really have to pay attention to the people, right? And the culture. And what was good about the company that you purchased, there was a reason you bought that company. What are the aspects you want to maintain of that culture? Who are the people that were going to be really valuable there? Doing the due diligence. And sometimes during the due diligence of an acquisition, that may not always be done. And so you need to understand that even deeper going forward, because if not, then that acquisition may not be successful. That's just, you know, being very, very candid here at the end of the day. So, and that's why, you know, when I've been involved with integration efforts, it's the first thing I try to understand is, okay, what was good in that culture before? Tell me about what this culture was like. Tell me about how this organization was run before, what worked well, and what are you glad or happy about now that you're part of this company, right? And then they'll tell you stuff, again, utilizing that effectively to do an effective integration. So this is somewhere I can help organizations as well. And again, in today's industry right now, and if you look, M&A is becoming more and more common, right? And it costs a lot of money. Well, you want to make sure you do it right. Right.
Well, thank you. And, you know, actually I did work on a couple of, you know, acquisitions and mergers myself. And it is an interesting place. I mean, there's a company I worked for a whole year preparing it, making sure that we get the balance correctly and the P&L right there, sure, where it's actually, you know, positive, where, you know, the acquisition can be, you know, I guess, fruitful to the party that are buying. Yeah, so it was kind of an interesting thing. And you're right, the cultures and all the stuff. So it's very difficult, you know, because there's different visions. And you know, we buy in the place, but, you know, so they have the expectation that we're going to just do this. But certainly if you're acquiring, I mean, obviously there's merger of systems, operations. Sometimes you consolidate.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
It becomes very
good. And it takes time.
It does. Yeah. I mean, most of these companies take a year, 2 years minimum to make a full transition, you know, from the time they start discussion, maybe even more. So it's a tough place. So now let's ask, you know, a couple of technical questions. I know, again, we're past the hour, but it's okay. We have a great discussion here. So one, what types of companies or growth stages benefit most from bringing in fractional executives? Executives, yeah. And how do you measure success in those short-term engagements? This is something that you're expert in. What is your take on that?
Yeah. So I, again, as far as size of company, it can be those that are probably a little further along than the smaller biotech company who are looking for seed funding and so forth. Those who've got a viable candidate that they can move forward with. And really what they're looking at is, you know, could be a couple of things. One, it could be, hey, we need to get our organization set up appropriately. You know, we want to make sure that what we have here, you know, that we got the right leaders in place, we got the right hierarchy in place. You know, what does that need to look like so we can effectively move our compound, you know, forward, right? Or we've got, you know, we are stuck. We can't effectively move something forward here. We need to come in and take a look at this. Give us 3 months. You know, we'll give you 3 months or 6 months to be able to give a recommendation on that. The other aspect is because as a scientist, right, and in my background from regulatory perspective, it could be, hey, we've got a compound right now that we're ready to take into phase one. We're ready to submit an IND package. Would you be able to look at this for us and be able to give your assessment of it, share the gaps that could be there, work with the FDA, and make sure that we've got a package here that's going to be successful and stand with us as we go through this. Those are sometimes longer engagements. So this could be 6 months, this could be a year, right? Depending on how much needs to be done there. So again, where I can help organizations, whether it's small, mid, or large companies, is getting their leadership and their people in place, and especially when they've gone through a difficult an integration, an acquisition, or any type of disruption, or I can help them on the technical end where they are in regulatory end, where they need to have someone, there that can be a partner with them, as well as the regulatory body that they're working with.
Perfect. Well, there's a couple more questions, and the last one will be the most important of all today. But so this one is very interesting. So with emerging tech and regulatory pressures evolving rapidly, right, what leadership traits do you believe will be most critical for pharma and biotech executives in the next 5 years?
Really being, it's empathy towards the people, right? Because the people are going through a lot of change here, right? Change and, adapting to these technologies, the impact it's having on their workplace, and then also the speed of which these things are going to get implemented, and again, there's regulatory pieces there that are tied with that as well. And, so this is where you need organizations to take the time, leaders take the time to really understand what this looks like at the ground level, right? Not just, hey, this is a technology that's come in, we've got to move it in here and get it done. No, take the time to really understand that, be empathetic towards those that you're working with. And that's one thing that I really take a lot of time as a leader, is to really understand that part of it. And does it take time? Yes, but it's important because there's so much that's changing so quickly. You have to appreciate that, right? And the people who are going to do that are those that are deep in the organization, that are the ones that are having to drive this change forward.
Thank you. And again, we see a lot of changes. There's AI now, there's all kind of stuff.
Oh,
we
sure.
We need to adjust everything. And we certainly, have to kind of merge all this stuff. And so the leaders of tomorrow, today and tomorrow, have to really adapt and really become, evolve, really. We have our tagline, it's time to evolve. We need to evolve to the next stage. And we can't live in the past. Things in the past are in the past. By the way, I see this even today. Like a friend of mine was, he was going for a job, a higher level, role. And the company he was dealing with, they're still asking him to do a PowerPoint and see whether he can do an Excel in the PowerPoint. I'm sorry, but dude, you PowerPoint is obsolete. It's gone. I don't need it. I can ask my chat, to give me a PowerPoint. I'll get the whole thing. I can write a whole program now without having to write, Python myself.
There's so many AI tools out there that'll just do it for you, right? You just give them the context of what you want. They'll spit out the present. Don't spend time on that. Where you want to spend time is really things that utilize your thought, your experience, and your ability to engage with people. Because that's something that these tools cannot do, right? That's where you need to spend the focus on. But yeah, that's where leaders have to come in there and help, right? Because there are going to be people in your organization that may not be as aware or as adaptable. How do you work with them now? So that's where you got to have those conversations and be empathetic of their state, and then help them come along if you can. Some cases you can't, right? And you try and you do it and you realize, okay, we're at a point where maybe we need to make a decision here at this point on how to move forward. But most of the time, you can help them along and say, hey, this is how things are evolving. This is what I need you to do at this point. Can you do it? Because what you did here 5 years ago is not how we can operate now, because there's too many other tools out there that we need to figure out how to use and bring those forward, right? And you talk about AI or any automation tools that are out there outside of that, you've got to be aware of those things as your organization, and you got to bring those things in effectively, but bring your people along with it.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm laughing. I'm listening to you. There's something called BC and PC, before COVID and post COVID. It's a joke, but really, COVID had taught us a lesson that things that we were told couldn't happen, did right. happen. I mean, many people were shying away from remote and hybrid and all this stuff. And guess what? Sure. We did well. We still managed ourselves throughout the season and you know, emerged, you know, most of the companies emerged really better and if not even more profitable, you know, and a lot of stuff because they cut a lot of costs and things like that. So it was good. And you know what? With the adoption of AI and these tools, I mean, this is the thing. PowerPoint and all these things were great tools at the time. You know, now you have the next level. You're the next level. That's it. Just move on. But here's the challenge. You mentioned something. If the leadership is still caught in that past, that's a problem, you know. And so, yeah. But if the leadership, you know, is evolving and they can bring everybody else to the next, you know, generation of operations, you can. And really, you can do a lot more stuff. Listen, I mean, I run, you know, a lot of stuff with my AI, you know, help, and it does terrific stuff for me. You know, I mean, from anything I want, I mean, from my newsletters, from my this, from the other, you know, structure stuff, I automate things. It makes my life a lot simpler in process. It can save money and cost, you know, to your point. Yep. And by the way, in the biotech and no pharma is already ahead of the game doing this. There are algorithms. I had a show about this. There are things that, you know, AI is doing already, cooking, you know, these formulas and things like it to see, is it going to work? You can throw in all the regulatory to it and it's going to calculate and tell you like, well, this is going to work. So you can cut a short time for a lot of things. So that's it. So here's the most important question after you commented. I think you wanted to interject. Go for it.
Yeah. So I think one thing with tools, and I think, you know, this was probably not a surprise, is that especially these automation tools, AI tools, it's as good as the data that you put into it, right? So that's where people have to come in and think about that. Okay, what am I putting into this to get the outcome that I want? And then when I get that outcome, how am I evaluating that outcome to make sure it makes sense, right? And that's where people can't go away, right? Whether it's in pharma or any other industry at the end of the day, is that experience, that awareness of what the data needs to look like or that information needs to look like, both on the input end and on the output end, is critical. So even I use AI tools and so forth, but I'm always checking it. I'm being very clear in my instruction of what I give in and what the outcome comes. And you continue to refine it and adapt to it and make sure that it's giving what it needs to do. So again, these tools are incredible, right, at the end of the day, but it's as good as the information you go in and how well that data is evaluated or information is evaluated and comes out. And that's where you still need people. So when people get worried about their roles being disappearing, no, not if you've got that experience and understanding of what type of industry that you work in.
That's right. I mean, AI is only gonna, you given it what you want to cook, it gives you 90% of it pre-cooked, and now you gotta do your piece. Like, you know, I need to tweak this, tweak that, the prompts. The more you it's like the guitar, right? You gotta keep tweaking until you get that best, you know, outcome, right?
That's a great analogy.
The piano, right? You gotta make sure it gives you that note, right? You know, bing, you gotta get the pin. Yeah. Same thing here. And by the way, if you don't know what you're talking about in the first place, you can't operate with AI. I mean, you got to give it the wrong prompt, it's going to give you the wrong answer. And if you don't know what to look for, I mean, so your expertise is still mandatory, it's still needed, and you will do
critical.
It. But you're like, again, exactly, it's more critical. But it will give you a shortcut in a lot of the process, and you'll be more efficient because there are things. And some AI now, and by the way, AI is adaptive. It adapts to you. The more it knows about you, the more it actually understands the stuff, it's going to give you more and better and more accurate stuff. You know, again, that's just my take on it. But really, the next 5 years is going to be epic if you are part of this new wave. If you're not, well, you're behind the eight ball. And, you know, it's going to be like, it's like, you know, watching a supersonic plane just took off, gone. And you'd be like, whoa, nice dust. I mean, not a good thing. All right. So here's the final question and the big one. How can our audiences out there, you know, in the biotech and pharma or other, you know, medical devices, you know, world, tap into your resource and your skills and, you know, expertise?
Yeah, best way to reach out to me, and it's, you know, I'm not a big social media person, it's LinkedIn, right? LinkedIn, you know, is, you know, for me, the best place to reach out to me via DM, Kalal Biswas, you know, so this is, you know, you know, and I'm a principal consultant, Biswas Consulting Services, LLC. Reach out to me. I love to talk to people. I'm happy to jump on a call with you, but reach out to me with that first DM and let me know who you are. Reach out to me with a connection request. Happy to accept your connection and see how we can work together. Right. So that's my best way to get me.
LinkedIn it is. I mean, I've been LinkedIn, you know, literally since it became in the first stages. Most people didn't even think like, oh, what's LinkedIn? I don't want to be on LinkedIn. That was Facebook days. Like, what's this about? It's like, this is where people get to engage, you know, in the business world.
Right.
It's the other, it's Facebook is for social. That's for business. We do things here. Now, of course, there's other things. And of course, LinkedIn evolved also over time and it changed a little bit how it operates. But at the end of the day, it is a good place and a good platform to connect with folks. And so, yeah, so guys, if you're out there and you're in the world of pharma, now again, I mentioned pharma, biotech. I mentioned medical devices. Any other industries that you actually cater to? Do you care to add any others, or that's it?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, what I've learned is that even tangential organizations in the healthcare industry, are appropriate. Where anytime you're dealing with disruption in your organization, or you're dealing with an M&A or an integration, or you're dealing with technical issues that your organization is facing. Again, primarily where I serve is the pharma, biotech, med device industry, as you said, but a lot of the problems that you deal with here are impact other organizations as well. So sometimes when leaders reach out to me, it's not because they're in these industries. They're dealing with people issues within their organization. Hey, I need to get my leaders in the right place. How do I do this? I can help you with that, and it doesn't have to be tied to this. And so I feel very blessed that I've been able to do these things and really be able to do it from a grassroots effort for many years, and I can help it in a lot of different ways. But again, if you talk about primary industry, pharmacy, med device, biotech industry, but outside of that, there's other things I can help as well, because these problems are not unique to this industry only.
Yeah, no, again, I can relate to all of them. I mean, what you describe here is across, I don't care what business in, what stuff. Obviously, the more expertise that is dedicated to the world that you have, the 30, sure, 20 plus years of, knowledge and skills, obviously, that's going to be, a quick, fix. But, these things are, equal across the board. So before we end our show, what are some of the three tips you want to share with the audiences today, whether they are in the business world or they just, by the way, I think everybody is in the business world, whether you're a consumer or not, you're in somehow in touch with business if you work somewhere in the business. So just to our audiences in general.
Yeah. Number one, and I've preached on it all, most of the hours, take care of your people, right? Your people are your assets of your organization. Take care of them, listen to them, and really put them in a position to succeed. And do that with as much energy as you can, right? Because that will pay dividend. Number two, I think, really never come into an organization with assumptions, right? Don't assume that you know what the problems are and what the issues are. Take the time to look at things. And don't look just within the organization that you're in. Look across, your tangential organization that I talk about. If you're running operations, look at your quality organization, look at your manufacturing organization, potentially look at, if you have a sales organization, look at those and understand that. Even look at your finance organization. So make sure you're looking at things and don't come with any preconceived notions. I think that's a really important piece. And third piece is, and this one might be a bit controversial, is don't focus on revenue alone. Businesses at the end of the day are, revenue is an outcome. But if you take care of your people, you do good science, and you run your operations effectively, the revenue will be there. You're both your top and your bottom line. You will hit those targets will be hit. May not happen overnight, but it will. But those are where you need to focus, starting with the people. So those are my takeaways. I would say as I think about this point, certainly there's other things as well, but those are the big ones I see.
Listen, I think if anyone watching and listening applies those three, they will be successful, because I can relate to all those. That's exactly it. I mean, it's all with the people. And again, you have to have the science, right? As you said, you got to get your numbers correct. You got to get your assumptions and all your mathematical stuff in place. And the rest is history. The outcomes will be there. And as you point, high and low, you can get your positives and you can get your expenses under control. Everything else is peachy. So Wow, that's been a great, terrific, a little bit of an hour, but you know what? It was worth every second of it. I enjoyed it. And I think, you know, the audience will definitely, you know, take a lot, you know, home. And again, business people out there, you know, this is a great show to apply. Even if it's not for you, maybe share it with your leadership and let them, you know, maybe share it with other people, because they're going to learn something here that's going to be valuable to their operation and get them to the next stage. All right. Well, so that's it. You know, thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Biswas. It was great stuff, man.
Yeah, really appreciate you, Hurricane, and thank you for having me on here. And the conversation was just fantastic, and hopefully, you know, maybe see you again in the future.
Oh yeah, listen, I do comebacks. I love those. I mean, and sequels are great, and there's a lot more. You know, listen, you have a lot more to offer than in 1 hour, so I can use more hours of yours, you know, and get it done. Hey, listen, we can even have your own show here, and just you know, put some outcome, you know, an output here to the folks out there. So there's a lot of stuff we can do. But so I enjoyed this, of course, and this is, you know, it's. As a business person myself, I love these things because it reinforces my practices, myself, and how I see things. And we're alignment. This is exactly how it's done. And anyone who's not in that alignment should. And again, it's just an opinion. Folks, if you don't, I mean, you'll see your results yourselves. You know, if they're not jiving, there's something wrong. Then look into where the areas of a need, and you'll find exactly, you know, what doctor was talking about is really what needed to be fixed. And then that's all you have to do. Or get doctor and that's it, and fix the problem there. All right, folks, that's it for us. This is the end of our show, American Age. Hope you enjoyed our discussion. We'll be talking soon. New day, new show, topic, new guest. Bye for now.